leave these up here for after. Oh, that was no challenge.
Well, I know. I was like, oh,
crap. Okay. There we go. Okay, hi there. Questions? Thank you, Talia, for getting those done and recorded and back. While finishing all of the papers for her courses, too. Sure glad I don't have to take courses. I don't know how you do it. But. The questions? Just do my thing, huh? Okay. I can. Okay. The exam is Monday. You know that. Review session after class in Fleming 101. Review sessions Friday and Sunday, both in Living Learning Commons 315. Bring a number 2 pencil to the final exam. Not to the review sessions, but to the final exam. Okay? And if you're registered for the course, you got an email from me this afternoon with that information. Now that you've copied it all down. It's also on the website. Okay, what I was doing on Monday was rolling through what I think are 3 important themes that help us organize our understanding of adulthood. And I had talked about the issue of changing identity and renegotiating identity to incorporate new experiences and new roles and new relationships into one's identity the rest of your life. After you get it together in adolescence and youth, then you get to change it over and over and over again. And the trick is, the task is, from Erickson's point of view, to keep your sense of identity intact so that you don't go through major periods of diffusion. And that requires constant reflection and assessment of how your roles and responsibilities and relationships and your coping with the events that are happening to you, how those are all contributing to your sense of who you are. Do they hang together? And then we had started talking about the issue of relationships, or the theme of relationships. As we go through adulthood, we're constantly changing relationships as we move from the family of origin, going out, to perhaps creating a family of affiliation, people that we hang together with and consider our family, the people we're close to, and eventually perhaps partner with and potentially create a family of procreation if we have the opportunity and choose to raise children in our adulthood. While you're leaving home, the adults are being left. That's the other side. And that happens to most of us who are lucky enough to have our kids leave home and stay away from home. But that means that we have to adapt to the empty nest, to having a home without kids in it, while we may have had children in it or growing people in it that we were responsible for 20 or 30 years or more. So one of the tasks of adulthood is to figure out how to be in a household without people that you have to be responsible for. Of course, we call those the launching years when we get rid of our children. And the dream is that we launch them and they go off and be successful and they have wonderful lives and they give us all the credit for it. That's the ideal, that's the dream. What really happens is that what we've launched is the space shuttle. It goes out and then it comes back periodically. And for some of us, that's a cycle that goes on for many years as kids find it difficult to find places or their relationships end and they need a place to be. Things sometimes don't go well for one or more of our children and we end up taking on the parental role again. But figuring out then how to have the now adults in the same household without falling back into the parenting role. How do you do that? It's a struggle for adults. The web of relationships for everyone in the family changes as people leave and as new people come into the family. There's a constant change in the family system, and one of the tasks for us is to cope with those changes when we may not be in charge of them. It's not our decision to have daughters-in-law. It's not our decision to have foster grandchildren or to have our children partner with people that we don't like. They make the decisions. And as I was emphasizing on Monday, or maybe it was Wednesday, I lose track too, one of the myths that we have is that we're in charge of the things that happen to us in our lives. And through adulthood, we discover that that's not the case. We're constantly adapting, making sense out of what other people are doing that impacts us. And as our family extends, those decisions may be less and less in our own hands. So we're giving up the responsibility for the direction of at least that part of our adulthood life, our adult life. We'll talk about that in great detail in HDFS 60 next semester, for those of you who are hanging around for that. In the realm of peers, we go off. We're establishing the skills of intimacy as Sullivan describes them. We're making commitments to people. We go to college. We have good friends. We live with people. And then you graduate. Whoops. And then you get to decide where you're going, and roommates and housemates and even partners often end up going in different directions. So there's a constant shift, potentially, in the friendships that we have with our peers. And of course, for many of you, the intimate peer, the partner, will be one of the most important relationships that you have, and you may go through several of those before making a commitment that lasts. As we go through adulthood, friends may diminish in their importance to us when we partner, particularly if we have children. Time becomes precious, and the responsibilities in the busy parenting years often make it difficult to maintain friendships, particularly if our friends don't have children the same age in the same school, or in the same church, or whatever organizations we're attached to. So we may become less involved with friends that we've been friends with for a long time, while they and we are involved primarily with parenting and with partner issues. With retirement, we often go back to those old friendships. It's a fascinating thing that used to fascinate me watching other people do it, and now I'm experiencing other people retiring. My old friends are retiring, and they've become a burden to me, quite frankly, because they all have email. And some of them are sitting around on their butts without enough to do, so they email me. And then after a week, if I haven't responded at length to their letters about how wonderful retirement is, I'm not going to respond to those, except to say, you know, keep it. I don't want it yet. But then they bug me because I'm not responding to them. So I have friends who are renewing acquaintance, people I haven't spent any time with for the last 20 years or 30, are getting in touch. We're all looking at our mortality in our 60s, and we're losing friends, and we're losing partners, and we're losing parents, and people are saying, well, I need to be in touch with these people who were important to me at some point in my life. So over the weekend, my cousin from California that I didn't see for 45 years, literally, did not see for 45 years, emailed me again. He came to visit this summer for the first time in 45 years. Because family is really important, and he's doing the genealogy. Monday, my cousin in Indiana called. I see him once every, average about once every 10 years. But it's increasing in frequency. Now it's been twice in the last 5 years. And he's thinking, okay, so when are you coming to see us? Having had nothing in common except that our mothers were sisters over the years, he now wants closeness. Don't tell him I said he's bugging me. He's not. He's a nice guy. But, you know, lunch, that's fine. That's enough. Or an overnight if he wants to come here. What has happened with technology is that high school classmates are forming chat rooms. You've seen those. I keep getting invited into the chat room that's been created by my high school class. And I haven't seen any of them for 20 years. I went to the 25th high school reunion. But they're all getting interested in checking out their childhood and finding the people that they knew in adolescence. And that's typical, that we want to renew those acquaintances. Remember on Monday I said that as we go through life, there are fewer and fewer people who have known us all of our lives because those people are dying off. So our peers become important because they are the ones with whom we have shared childhood and adolescence and college and young adulthood or whatever experiences we've had. And as our children leave and we retire, we have the time and the motivation of what Butler calls the life review of figuring out what sense our lives make. Does my life make any sense? As I go back through and figure out, okay, I was the kid from wherever I was from that little town, from this high school. How do I make sense out of where I am now, and what's the continuity? So it's partly identity. It's partly just the issue of integrity, or the task of creating a sense of integrity that Erickson talks about in later adulthood, that people are beginning to work on. And they're using technology to do that, to get confirmation of the pranks we pulled in high school, the relationships that were terrible and disastrous in high school that now people literally want to talk about. They didn't talk about them for 40 years, but they want to talk about them now and apologize to each other for the way we treated each other when we were 16. I'm not sure I want to participate in that yet. I don't want to know how many people I treated badly in high school. I don't need that yet. I know it was large. I know it was a big number. I don't need to be reminded. Okay. And then there's partnering, that part of the relationships. Figuring out how to have a partnership, how to collaborate with another person on the daily activities of life, on perhaps being responsible for the next generation, of supporting each other through our adult development, of maintaining a relationship and intimacy through all the trials and tribulations that may befall us, and keeping a relationship going while two people are both changing. And as you know from the divorce statistics, while they're improving, we're down from 51% to 48% of first marriages end in divorce within the first 20 years. You know that that's difficult. It can be done, but it is not an easy task. And half of us don't make it in the first committed partnership that we get into. And that's only the marriage statistics. That doesn't deal with the cohabiting statistics. Cohabiting relationships have a higher rate of dissolution. And I'm not going to go through that part of this at the moment, but to point out that as you take on the tasks of adulthood with a partner, the research, as it's described in the text, is very consistent. If you look at marital satisfaction, as your satisfaction with your partnership through adulthood, that's the curve that everybody gets. You're most satisfied with each other the day you get married, or maybe the day before, depending on how well the wedding goes and the reception. And then the honeymoon is over, and most couples show a decline in satisfaction with each other when the honeymoon is over. My wife and I are waiting for that. We're about to celebrate our 6th anniversary. We're waiting for the honeymoon to be over. Fortunately, second marriages, by the way, have a higher rate of divorce than first. But when they're good, they're really, really good. So my recommendation usually is just to skip the first one. Just wait till you're 50. No, okay. You don't believe that. Anyway. So what do we mean by stage of the family life cycle? Well, it starts to go down. Its fastest decline is when you have 2 preschool-age children. And it hits bottom when you have 2 early adolescents in the household. Adolescents are terrible for marriages. You were. Just ask your parents. Adolescents, by the nature of the development they're going through puberty and development of cognitive skills, create conflict between couples. And the curve starts to rise when the first child leaves home. So if you're the first who left, take some satisfaction in the fact that your parents, if they've survived that low point and they're still together, they're going to become happier with each other because you're gone. If they survive it. Okay. And then it goes back up. And stage 4 is when everybody's left and you've adapted to not having kids around, and some of you who are in that situation with your parents, you're the last one, and you call them and they're not there, and you need something and they're not there. Or you tell them you're coming home for the weekend, and they say, that's fine, we'll leave the key under the mat, because they're not going to be there. It's because they're working on their relationship and enjoying the freedom that comes when they don't have to worry about you day to day. Couples who don't have children are an interesting group of people. And there is a fair amount of literature on them. The text gives, I think, about one paragraph to people who don't have children and who don't take on the raising of other people's children. It depends. There are actually 2 different groups. One is the group of parents who choose not to have children, people, partners, who choose not to have children. And people tend to do that because they don't like little kids and they have other things to do with their lives and they prefer to do them. The second group are people who, for whatever reason, cannot have children, though they would like to have them. And they're the ones who typically go through a variety of efforts to try to either have children, surrogate parenthood, or artificial insemination, or all of those other biological possibilities, or adopt or take in foster children. And they're different. If they're unsuccessful in finding any way to parent, the two different groups remaining childless have slightly different paths. But they tend to find other ways of being generative, in using Erickson's term. And there's some debate in the literature about what personality characteristics tend to emerge. They tend to have more time for hobbies, for other activities. Many of them spend their lives working. Some of them get to do a lot more traveling. Some of them get involved in social activities, social projects, politics, you know, all kinds of things. They have more time than parents. That's one of the issues. And then the question is how they fill that time. And that depends on their values and their skills and their opportunities.
Do you tend to see the same curve, or do you not see it because you don't end up with
poverty? That's an interesting question. Do you see a change in, or a course in marital satisfaction that mirrors that one? I don't know. That's an interesting question. Tally, would you write that one down? Because I think the literature includes that, but I've not paid any attention to it. Anecdotally, the couples that I know who have voluntarily remained childless, well, there are two groups that I know, and this isn't data, so don't take it. I happen to know a number of couples who, for one reason or another, don't have children. The ones who decide in their 20s not to have children either change their minds or divorce and change their minds. And the lesson that I have drawn from that, watching a number of couples go through this, is if a woman tells you she doesn't want to have children and she is not yet 32, do not believe her. And certainly do not commit yourself in a marriage that is based on her choice not to have children. She's likely to change that. When we talk about the biological clock, it's very important. The examples of that, I have two friends who, it was a big thing in the 70s to decide not to have children because it was a terrible world and the world was overpopulated and you didn't want to bring, and you wanted to do good. And both couples that I know who undertook marriage with that contract divorced. One of them when the woman decided she wanted children, and the other when the man decided he wanted children. And so the marriage, they couldn't agree, the marriages broke up. The irony of one of them is that the woman who didn't want children precipitated the divorce when her husband decided he did in his 30s. And he has never remarried and never had children. He was the one who wanted them. She, the one who didn't want them, eventually married and had three. Okay, enough anecdotes. That's a very interesting question. It would make an interesting course to look at the impact of the parenting process. One of the issues for people who don't have children is that the world is focused on people who do have children. And there have been several books written about that. One of them is Momism, about how difficult it is to be a childless woman, particularly if you're married, in our society, because you take a lot of grief from a lot of people who assume it's their business to understand why you don't have children. And that's a difficulty. The other important topic about partnering is to, for me, is to think about why we do it. And you have Robert Sternberg's description of what he calls the three types of love, the components of love in his case. Let me put this one up first. It's simpler. Sternberg, who's looked at love and couple relationships over the years, says there are three aspects to love, or three components, and one is passion. That's the biological, the chemistry, the part of it. Intimacy, which Sullivan is talking about. The emotional component that's focused on the relationship itself and the other person's personality and spirit. And commitment, which I think of as the cognitive part of love, of deciding to share life with another person and focus on that relationship. Sternberg argues that these three come in different degrees in different relationships, and that you can think about, and the text describes each of the components in a little more detail, you can think about how much passion a relationship has, how much intimacy, and how much commitment. And when you put those together in different degrees, you have different kinds of relationships. And that's what he presents in his other, in his triangle, that if you have just intimacy or just commitment or just passion, that's three types of relationships. But you can also then combine intimacy and passion into what he calls romantic love, intimacy and commitment, which is what we call companionate love. The passion is missing, but people may be very happy and very intimate together. And passion and commitment without intimacy, he calls fatuous or empty. You're committed to it, and the passion is there, but the two people are not intimate with each other. And then if you put all three together, you have what he calls consummate love. That's what you're really looking for. And those are the relationships that are most satisfying. But it's kind of interesting to watch people put together relationships. And you can think about your own, sort of assess them. Sternberg actually has an assessment tool you can use to look at your relationship and put it in one of those categories. Question often comes up about which ones of those are likely to last, and intimacy is an important component of lasting, and commitment is an important component of lasting, but there is a fourth component in Shelton's humble view, which is what I consider the fourth component, is compatibility. I have seen relationships that are very intimate. I've seen very committed relationships. Also seen very passionate relationships. But it's possible to be incompatible, even though you have all of those three elements. So a lasting relationship needs to, I think, attend to all three, all four. Adding the compatibility. Is this a person whose quirks you can live with, or is this a person who's going to drive you nuts, no matter how intimate you might be or how committed you might be to the relationship? The relationship will have more conflict if you're truly incompatible people, and people can be incompatible and be very nice, and they can be passionate, they can have all of the chemistry, they can be very intimate, but not be able to live together without driving each other nuts. We'll elaborate on that maybe between semesters. Other transitions or events that are important for couples include the empty nest, which we've already talked a little bit about. When the kids leave, what's the couple doing? One of the issues both in empty nest and retirement is that couples now have more time and they don't have the diversion of kids, or in the case of retirement, work, to keep them from having to deal with each other. So a challenge is coping with the transition of having two people in the same space, just the two of them, for much longer parts of the day. And those are both conflict-producing events. The empty nest, parents sometimes look at each other and say, okay, the kids are gone, we're not actively parenting anymore, who are you? And why are we together? So there is a bump in the divorce statistics when the nest empties, as people decide they've been together primarily because they're responsible for children together, and when kids go off to college, they can do that separately, and they don't need to bother each other anymore. Retirement is a problem because people have to adapt to not having the schedule that goes along with work and the responsibilities, the activities that go along with work, and there you are. As someone famous once said after her husband retired, I married him for better or for worse, but not for lunch. So she went out and got a job. Divorce is another major transition, obviously, for couples, and puts both people into a new relationship mode. And we'll deal with that in a couple of other courses, too. Some of you are watching your parents go through that, painfully watching them go through adolescence again, figuring out how to be intimate, how to have relationships, and that's a topic in itself. The third major thread is career. Many of you are focused right now on preparing for a career. What's it going to be? Can you find a job? The task that we watch adults go through, sometimes once, sometimes over and over again, is the task of constructing a career that's consistent with your identity and your talents and your background and your training and all of that. And finding a career that, a way to support yourself that uses the opportunities that you have. Some people have more opportunities than others. There's a gender difference in how people go about doing that and the importance they give it. That's changing as more and more women are in the workforce and are challenging the glass ceiling and wanting the same kinds of careers that men have. Men sometimes ask, why would people want that? But if they want to be equals and do it the same way, more power to them. Whether you're going to be productive or not, and what your parents and other loved ones expect of you is part of that task, putting that together. To what degree do you meet the expectations of your parents? What do you do with parents who are high achievers, and you look at them and say, nah, I don't want to. I want the job at the post office, which has a good salary, and I don't have to take anything home, and then I can work on whatever I want to and go to NASCAR races or whatever turns you on. And parents may be dissatisfied with the choices that their kids make. So that's a challenge for both the parents and the kids. The challenge for many of us is to accept the fact that kids get to make their own decisions, and we don't get to make them for them, and they get to have their own lives, and they get to construct their own careers, and it's not our job to tell them what to do. And the last theme is figuring out, where are you going to be in society? Literally, where are you going to live? Where are you going to go after you graduate? You stay in Burlington, go back home, go to California, travel in Europe, go to Japan, China's the new frontier. Where are you going to live? It's a huge world. And many of us have the option of where we go in it. How do you make that decision? You will get to make that decision, most of you. Some of you can't imagine going any place but the community you grew up in. Others of you wouldn't go back there for love or money. and the rest of you fall someplace in between. Where you will end up going depends on what kinds of relationships you're in and what kinds of career opportunities you want, what kinds of career opportunities are presented to you. Sometimes you have a lot of choice, sometimes you don't have much choice. Beyond that, what kind of community do you want to be in? Even if you decide you want to go to California, what kind of community? You want the single life? You want the high, fast life? Do you want the quiet suburban life? Do you want to live in the hills outside San Francisco? How are you going to support the lifestyle that you would like to have? What groups are you going to join? What candidates are you going to work for? What religious organizations? All of those are choices that you get to make. And the choices that you make early on will limit some of the choices that you have later. They will direct the course of opportunities that you have. And one of the frustrating things for many of us is that there are, from this point, at this point in your life, there are an infinite number of lives you can live. Just an infinite number. And choice points and events that will happen to you along the way, and each time an event happens or you make a choice, the number of possible lives decreases a little bit. But most of the time, you will have too many choices. And for at least the next decade, you probably won't want to limit your choices. But then you have to make decisions. Challenge. So have fun. Then you get to retire. You get to decide whether you want to go to Sun City or California or a nursing home or assisted living or all of those other possibilities. Preparing for and choosing places to live as you get older becomes a challenge often that you share with children and often depends on the resources that you have available. How are you going to retire? Are you going to be active? Are you going to go sit on your butt and go fishing? Are you going to stay involved in the community as long as you possibly can? Are you going to get too busy? How are you going to be a participant, and to what degree are you going to be a participant in the community that you live in? Are you going to stay in the community the rest of your life? Or are you going to retire to Florida as soon as you possibly can? We need to talk about the end of the lifespan. We need to talk about death. Sorry, but we need to talk about it. And I'm going to kind of introduce the last part of the course today by pointing out that we're looking at three domains. We have the biological, the cognitive, and the psychosocial. And death involves all three of those, although it is primarily a biological event. It has a biological definition. It's when your body loses its ability to maintain the processes that are necessary for life. So you lose your integrity. Your kidneys fail. Your heart stops. You have a stroke. Your brain floods with blood. There are all kinds of ways to die. Ideally, you'll wait a while. 96 or 100 or 110 sounds like a good age. And then you'll do it suddenly. Remember, in the biological unit, we talked about the life maintenance reserve and rectangularizing the life span, keeping your life maintenance reserve as high as possible for as long as possible. And to the extent that you can do that, you will spend less time in a biologically fragile or compromised state. So you spend less time in a nursing home. You'll spend less time in the process of dying, which may take years for some of us. And you will spend less time dying. You will die more quickly. And everybody I've talked to who has a choice wants to die quickly. Let's just not wake up some morning. Let's drop dead doing our favorite things. That's the best way to go. And the best way to make sure that that happens is to stay active and to stay as fit as possible, given whatever challenges your body presents to you. But biologically, death is an interesting and complex process that can take a long, long time or a very short time. Cognitively, it is for the individual, I suppose, the end of understanding, the end of constructing meaning. And as I typed that this afternoon, I was thinking, yeah, maybe, or depending on your spiritual inclination and preference, it might be the beginning of all understanding. I'll let you know after I die. We used to joke when I was in college. I took Eric Erickson's course, and he went through his eight stages, and we used to comment on the fact that Erickson had written about each of the stages after he'd gone through them himself, and at the time I took the course, he was entering late adulthood and was writing about the last stage, integrity. So we wondered, of course, what he would do after he died. Is there a ninth stage? And we used to fantasize that the manuscript would come floating down from among the clouds, and it would have the description of the ninth stage. Actually, after he died, I haven't mentioned this, the UVM Library Media Service has two wonderful videos that are interviews of his wife, Joan. And their title is Joan Erickson at 90 and Joan Erickson at 92, I think. Anyway, the first one was done when Erickson was senile and in a nursing home. She describes the process of putting him in a nursing home. The second one is after he died. And they're absolutely marvelous, marvelous interviews of a wonderful old woman who talks about her notion of a ninth stage beyond integrity. And she calls it trying to keep everything together, just trying to maintain your dignity while your body is failing on you. It's an interesting interview, and I recommend it for your after-exam enjoyment. Is VHS videotapes. So I don't know what's going to happen cognitively. Psychosocially, the individual is, to the extent that you have the possibility of anticipating your death, which you all do in some way, but as you get older, you will anticipate it more concretely as you move from thinking about how many years you've been alive to how many years you likely have left. And that's a switch that takes place sometime in the 40s or 50s as people start, instead of counting up, start counting down. And it's a subtle but significant shift in thinking. People go from thinking about how many years they've worked to how many years they have till retirement. Or thinking about, well, if I get 70, that's 70 years, if you take the biblical promise. You get 70, so that's 70, so I'm 64 now, so what do I do with the next 5.5 years? But we don't believe in 70 anymore because the lifespan is 110. So I'm off the hook with that. But every day, you are reminded in some way, and your parents and your grandparents are reminded that they are not going to live forever. And anybody who believes that he or she will live forever is deluded and probably avoiding the reality of making preparations. If your parents don't have wills, you're in deep trouble. Make sure they do, because you inherit the problems if they both go at the same time, along with whatever else you inherit. Many of us have the opportunity to grieve our own lives and our own deaths before we die, because we have lots of warning. We have a terminal illness, we get cancer, doctor says, well, you got 3 or 4 months to put your affairs in order, and then you'd better order your casket, because actually doctors don't talk like that, because most doctors hate death, they're afraid of death, they won't talk to you about death, they will avoid it at all costs, and many of us have to force our physicians to talk about death. They've trained their whole lives to put it off, right? Nurses often have the same problem. We as a society have the problem of talking about death. We don't like to talk about it. We have all kinds of euphemisms about it, you know, passing, moving on, whatever, fading away. The dear departed, where'd he go? Right? Died. It is helpful to the process of dealing with grief. It is helpful to be able to talk about it directly. Avoidance gives people the message that there's something wrong with feeling the grief. And the grief is natural, the grief is inevitable, and coping with loss, coping with the death of somebody who's important to you, requires that you acknowledge, accept, and express the grief that that death causes you. That is our natural response. It is a human response. It is also a mammalian response. Other species experience grief. And to the extent that we don't express it when somebody dies, when we try to deny it and do the stiff upper lip thing, to the extent that we deny it and don't express it, our own development is hindered. Dealing with the loss of somebody that you love or who's important to you requires that you acknowledge the grief and express it. Then you can begin to move on. You can begin to cope with the loss of relationship. What happens when people deny their own grief is that they get stuck and they can't make the adjustments that are necessary. They don't incorporate the loss into their own lives and figure out how to go on about life without the person who died. So they don't go on. They just stay stuck. And that can lead long-term to depression. It can lead to psychophysical disorders. It can lead to not being able to do anything. So we need to express it. We need to help other people express it. I don't know what it's like to die. I haven't been there. And we have some literature about what the process is when people think they're going to die and then don't, or even when we think they're dead and then they revive. And that's an interesting literature, the near-death experience or the death and revival experience. What I'm most familiar with is the experience of grieving the death of someone who's close. We're the ones who are left. We're the ones who are with the grief. We don't know what the person who died felt at and after death. We may know about panic. We may know about fear and depression and denial before death. But when somebody dies, then we get to talk about it. We get to try to express our own grief in healthy ways. Healthiest is crying. That's what grief is about. And we get to help other people grieve when other people are experiencing loss, the death of someone important to them. We have to find ways of encouraging their grief and supporting them through it. And one of the things I've learned from grieving people over the years and from the psychological literature is that it's best just to put your foot right in it and encourage it and sit with it and not let it panic you. One of my early lessons came from a friend of mine whose husband was a race car driver and was killed in a race. And they had three children, two preschoolers and a second grader. And so she was faced with raising those kids alone, which she's done a wonderful job of. But a number of years later, I was in a group with her, and she was talking about the process, the experience of losing her husband. And they lived in a neighborhood that had a number of race car drivers and their families in it. and of course her husband's death made mortality more real to all of them, and particularly the wives didn't want to talk about it. They wanted to pretend it didn't happen because they needed to pretend that it wouldn't happen to their husbands. So when they would see her, as she described it, they'd be in the grocery store and she'd see them in the frozen food aisle, or she'd turn the corner and there they'd be. And she said suddenly they would be interested in whatever was at the back, at the bottom of the frozen food case. And they would stick their head in there and wait long enough for her to have gone away so they wouldn't have to deal with her. She said after a few months of watching her friends and neighbors do this, avoiding her, she said she developed this kind of game where she would hang around and make sure they knew she was hanging around until they got frostbite. Eventually they had to come up for warmth. When she talked to people about it, they didn't want to see her cry. And they were afraid to talk to her because they would cry, and they didn't want to do that. So the denial of the grief, the avoidance of the expression of the grief, led everybody just to avoid it. And she knew that that's not what she wanted. She wanted people to cry with her. She wanted people to grieve with her and talk about her husband. She didn't want his memory to die. She wanted people to be willing to talk to her children about their father, to validate their experience, and to help them with their grief. It's a very simple request, extremely difficult. So I asked her, among other things, what would you have wanted to do, people to do? And she said, just come up to me and say, literally, I don't know what to say. There's nothing I can say that'll help. But I acknowledge your husband's death, and I acknowledge your grief, and I share it with you, and let's just be totally inarticulate, blubbering together. And she said that would have been most helpful. You don't have to say the right thing. There isn't any right thing. You just need to share the grief, and you need to support the person who is grieving and not avoid it. And if you're grieving, you need to reach out to other people and encourage them to do that. You need to cry with other people. One of the experiences that I've had here, too many times to count, is people who lose a family member or a friend and think that they need to come back to school the next week and go on as if nothing happened and just do it. It shouldn't bother them. And I don't know where they get that message, but it shouldn't bother you. So people who lose parents, a few years ago was a student in this class whose fiance got killed tragically, and he never talked to anybody about it. I didn't even know it, because people don't want anybody to know. They just want to go on about their life. It shouldn't bother me. I should be strong enough to just go back and do 15 credits and get an A- or B, and this grief should not interfere with anything that I'm doing. John Wayne was an idiot emotionally. People need to reach out. If you know somebody has lost a significant person, you need to reach in and pull them out. Don't let them not express their grief. If you need to take time off, take time off. If you need to talk to people, talk to people. It will interfere with the work, and that's when things crash down and people are at their wits' end and failing because they're grieving and they're not able to deal with the grief and academics at the same time, because they're not really dealing with the grief. But they don't realize that until things come apart. You have to adapt your life to accommodate the absence. When I was studying grief therapy, one of the things that I found interesting was that everybody said there's a rule of thumb. After somebody dies, particularly this was a seminar on partner's death, it takes a year. It takes a year to go through the active grief. And that turns out to be an interesting rule of thumb, but I didn't understand it until a very wise mother of mine talked about that when my brother died. He was 40, my older brother. And my mother was talking about the experience that she was about to have after his funeral. And she was counting up with my sister and me. She said, okay, this is the eighth time I've been through this. She had lost both of her parents. She had lost an older sister. She had lost a daughter and a son now. She'd lost her husband. My father had died. And she had lost her mother and father-in-law. So she had eight significant people in the immediate family had died. And my brother was the eighth. So she said, you know, it's interesting. I know exactly what's going to happen. I know when I'm going to cry. I know what's going to trigger it. I know when I'm going to be sad. I know that this is going to last a year, and then it'll start getting better. And, you know, the psychologist in me said, a year? Why a year? And she looked at me respectfully like, duh. You have to go through every holiday without the person who died. You have to figure out how to do New Year's and your anniversary and Christmas and the person's birthday, and the whole calendar will constantly give you reminders, and each of those reminders will hurt and you will cry and you will get through it. And after you've gone through the whole calendar year, which goes up to the death of the person that you're grieving, then the new calendar starts, and it's now the second time around for each of those events. And you can start doing them differently now. You've been through it once. And she gave the rule of thumb content for me. So now I understand why it takes a year. And she just said, there's nothing frightening about it. I just know what it's going to be, and there's no way to change that. So no matter how many times you've been through it, it'll still be the same. And when it happens the ninth time or the tenth time, it'll be the same.
Okay, Tom? When someone's denying grief, you have to reach in there and pull them out.
Yep.
But I feel like the common response to that is an anger response, get away from me, you don't know what I'm going through. Do you know how to cue when they're ready for you to pull them out?
The response, the observation, it's a very good observation, is that often when you reach in, as I suggested you do with somebody who's grieving, that's what I meant by putting your foot in it. You just, doesn't matter, you can put your foot in your mouth, put your foot in the person's grief. You reach in and offer a hand. Sometimes the response to that is anger and the comment that you don't know what I'm going through, leave me alone. And then the second question was, how do you know when somebody is ready for you to reach in? I don't know about knowing when somebody is ready. There are probably some cues to that, but I also wouldn't wait until the person is ready, because that might not happen. The response to the anger is a part of grief. You are angry appropriately because you are grieving, and this person died, and that was a stupid thing for the person to do. And it was an unnice thing for the person to do, because it caused you all this grief and deprived you of them. I have a problem. I'll just share it briefly. I grew up in Protestant Christianity, and I've had a problem for many years with funerals, because the tendency in the traditions that I've experienced is for clergymen to tell everybody in the congregation at a funeral to rejoice and not grieve. And I had words with the clergyman at my father's funeral about that. I said, I think you're doing a disservice. You can tell us to rejoice for my father because he's in heaven, if that's what we believe, and if he deserved to go there, okay, anyway. That's okay, but don't tell kids in the audience and don't tell family members not to grieve. That's not healthy. Tell them to grieve joyously. And we had a conversation about how you can have a funeral where people grieve joyously. That's commemorating the existence and the effect. But let me be angry about having lost this person. So when somebody tells me, you don't know what I'm going through, I can say, that's true. Help me understand. Talk to me about it. Or just let me sit with you and try to feel what you're feeling. So you're there. You don't take the anger personally. It's a normal response. And you float with that and encourage. You encourage it. And the lesson for the rest of us is if we're the grieving one and somebody reaches in, inhibit your anger. You know, don't drive them away. They may be a little tentative about this. Say, thank you. Thank you. Now sit with me. Lisa?
What was the common thread you saw on campus after the show?
I'm sorry?
The common thread that you saw on campus after the show?
After Michelle's death this semester, I don't know that I saw common threads. I saw all kinds of variety of response. I saw denial. I saw blaming the victim. I heard comments that made it her fault. I heard anger. I heard shared fear for all of us. We're all over the place. There's so many of us at so many different points in our life, and so many people who were friends of hers in dealing with it in different ways. What I saw that I liked was the institutional response was not avoidance, denial, or blame. There was support all over campus, and I value that, and I'm proud of the university for what it did. We might have done more. Continuing one's own life. That's part of the grieving process. I'm living, and I deserve to continue to live, and the person who has died would not want me to stop living. That's an article of faith for me. Therefore, I get to figure out how to keep living, even if it's somebody who was very close to me or very dear to me. I have the opportunity to learn, reflect as part of my grief, what I've learned from the person and from the relationship that I had with the person. That's part of what funerals are for. I have the opportunity in death to learn from the experience. What do I learn from the experience of loss? My own response to it. How do I understand it? Journaling is my way of dealing with that. What did I learn from this experience? What did I learn about myself? What did I learn about life? And finally, the last piece, and this is a part that's helps me understand the process of grief, particularly when someone dies who is young, and gives me an idea about how to help family and friends when someone has died young. And that is to use the lifespan notion, which we have in this course, that's what it's about. There is an implicit lifespan for everyone who is conceived. Implicit means that it's there even though it's not completed. And I first became aware of this when I encountered parents who had lost a 4-year-old son in an accident. And I was invited to the birthday party for their son on his 8th birthday, 4 years after he died. And I went. And it was an amazing experience because it's a very nice dinner. And once a year, on his birthday, they set a place for him. And they had a birthday cake. And they brought out photos, the albums, they talked about him, and they acknowledged that he would have been in third grade. And all of his friends, who were the same age, were in third grade. And they were keeping his memory alive in a very specific and concrete way, acknowledging they knew the year he would graduate from high school. They knew the year he would graduate from college. They knew when his friends were going to get married. They knew when his friends would have children. They knew how old he would be, and they would know that the rest of their lives. And they were very clear and articulate about that. I have since learned that we all do that. We all know how old someone who's close to us would be and what he or she would be doing. And there's very nice evidence that when we don't acknowledge it, we get depressed around those times. I have personally dealt with parents who were grieving and not knowing it and didn't understand. In fact, one couple I dealt with who were divorcing were depressed and angry with each other, and they decided to divorce, and they were trying to figure out what to do about their children, which is why they came to me. And in the process of finding out about the family, I discovered that their problems had started about 6 months before, and they had very quickly come to the decision to divorce. And when they mentioned along the way, when I said, give me the ages of the children, when they were born and all that, they mentioned that they had a daughter who had died when she was, I don't know, 8 or 9. And so I said, okay, so when was she born? And it just occurred to me that the time they started their marital discord and started fighting with each other was the month leading up to when she would have graduated from high school. So I asked them, did you acknowledge, did you go to your daughter's friend's high school graduation? And there was this, huh? No acknowledgement. They had both just put it aside. But they were both aware that their daughter would have been graduating from high school, and they had done nothing to help each other through that, and nobody else had noticed it. So it was just gone. And on the basis of that, you know, every once in a while you get to do something really helpful for people. I said, you know, I'm not sure this is about you. It may be about her name. And I said, you know, before you go through with this divorce, could I recommend a counselor to help you go back and think about how you've dealt with her death and what that's done to your marriage? And they did. And they didn't divorce. Yeah. That was a very concrete example for me of how we keep that alive even if we're not aware of it. And it affects us. It affects our relationships and our mood and our behavior because we're not acknowledging it. So, the advice is to acknowledge that. I celebrate my father's birthday. I celebrate my sister's birthday. I celebrate my brother's birthday. I celebrate Eric Erickson's birthday, Harry Sack Sullivan, Sigmund Freud. And I'm adding Maria Montessori this year. You know, all these important people who've been important to me, I need to celebrate their birthdays to keep them alive in some way. Okay, let's see. I have another half hour. Right. I know I don't. What do? We construct a life. We are a biological organism making sense out of our experience in a very social context through all the relationships. So, how do you use this course? One way is whenever you encounter a person, ask yourself, and maybe the person, how the three domains are intertwined to form this particular person. Where is this person in development? And what is going on in each of the domains for this person? What transactions and experiences has this person made sense out of in his or her life? How does this person view or react to the world and life and relationships? How has this person constructed a way of being in the world? What is the person facing now? And how are all three domains involved in what the person is facing now? And then finally, what can you do in your transaction with this person to help this person make meaning and have healthy transactions? On the website, there is the paradigm I showed you the first day, and a series of potential transitions. As examples, what I would like you to be able to do as a result of the material that we've been through and the viewpoints that you've heard and sitting here for a semester, remember September? Even August when we started. I'd like you to be able to think about any particular point in a person's lifespan and think how those three domains are all involved. So, for example, if you look at, as one example, that's all I'm going to give, just one. When a person experiences the birth of her first child, what are the biological changes? It's a biological event, of course. But what are the cognitive challenges? What are the new experiences the person is going to have to make sense out of? Is the person prepared for making sense out of the experiences? And then, what in the psychosocial domain is the person going to have to deal with? Change in the partner relationship, changes in priorities, changes in commitment to work, new identity, a new role as parent. And you can elaborate those changes for any transition that a person goes through, whether it's a biological transition, a cognitive transition, or primarily a psychosocial transition. It will involve all three. And your challenge, now that you understand human development fully, is to be able to think about all three of those domains and how they work together. And when you're thinking about a person as a patient in the hospital, what's going on psychosocially for that person? What cognitively is the person faced with? When you're a teacher dealing with a kid going through puberty, what are the cognitive demands of that? How is that changing psychosocial relationships? Okay. So that's all the time we have. And I'll end with a gift. It's the giving season. So here's what you get. My wish that you construct for yourself a life that is interesting, satisfying, challenging, and useful, and that you make the world a better place. I wish for you the ability to be aware of your own development, reflection, and the ability to appreciate the changes as you go through them. I would give you the courage to examine your experience carefully and to make changes in your life where you can. And I would give you the disposition to be at peace with yourself and with the world sometimes, if not all the time. Thank you very much, and we'll have a review session in a few minutes.